Okay. I want to thank those responsible for our being here. This clubhouse is just awesome, y'all. I'm sure you know that. It's wonderful. For the first 20 years of my recovery, I went to a clubhouse similar to this, and I'm very familiar with the ins and outs and the intricacies of it and all it takes to keep it going, so congratulations to all of you for doing that. All right, I heard somebody say one time that Al-Anon is all about relationships, and I will tell you that I do believe that it is all about relationships, but also for me, it has been a lot about hope, and it's been a lot about miracles, and I hope I get to share some of those this morning. I was raised in a military family. My dad was an Army officer, and so that meant that we were always moving, thinking about moving, packing or unpacking. That was just the story of our lives. And my dad was not an alcoholic. He truly was a social drinker. There are such people, and my dad was one. I saw him actually a little tipsy a couple of times in my life, and he would come home from a military function when this happened, and he would be so happy, and he'd go over to the phone and get out his address book, and he would call all of his old Army buddies, and they would reminisce on the phone, and it was so much fun because he talked very little about his military experiences, so I got to hear about some of that when he would have those phone conversations. My mother was an alcoholic, and she was quite physically abusive to me, so she and I had a pretty tumultuous relationship for a lot of my growing up years. I have a brother, Glenn, who is 7 years older than I am, and Glenn has experienced a lot of things in his lifetime and probably could be in a lot of different rooms, but he was a math and science genius growing up and still is to this day, and he excelled at every sport he ever played. If it involved a ball, he excelled at it. He was the pitcher on the baseball team and the quarterback on the football team and the forward on the basketball team and whatever you are, head of the golf league and the bowling league. And when I was born, he was already kind of out of the house doing his sports thing. And then there was me, and I lived my life in books. I believe I've read every day of my life since I learned the alphabet. And I learned pretty quickly as an Army brat that if I said hello to you, that meant I would have to say goodbye to you. And I did not like saying goodbye. So I could immerse myself in those books and fall in love with the people and places in those books, and I never had to tell them goodbye. And that was me. I substitute teach on occasion, and a few years ago I saw me for the first time in my life. I was substituting in a middle school class, and there was this young girl there. She came in, she had her books, and she had her book, and she sat down, and she opened up her book, and she read her book until we went to lunch, and we went to lunch, and she had that book under her arm, and we got to the lunchroom, and she sat down, and she opened up that book. And that was me. And I never realized until that day what a barrier that book is, how secure you can be inside the bubble of that book. I hope I don't use books that way so much today, but I still do enjoy reading very much. And so that was my family. And if you saw us, you would say, man, look at them. They are great. I wish our family was like them. But really, inside that house, we were four islands. We would come together for dinner because that was really important to my mom. But the rest of the time, we just lived on our individual islands in that house. And that's how I grew up. Of course, there came a time the opposite sex became quite attractive to me. And this is what he was like back then. He was tall, kind of dark-haired. He would walk in a room and people would say, oh, look, he's here, he's here. You know people like that, you know. Oh, we're so glad he's here. He could tell a story. He could make you believe anything about anything. He knew how to treat a woman when he was dating her. He liked to kind of live life on the edge. Like he drove race cars fast, or he drove motorcycles fast, or he skydived, or there was just something about that living life on the edge kind of guy that just called out to my spirit. It just called out to me. And that was him. He also, in my experience, had either been physically and or sexually and or emotionally abused growing up. He physically and or sexually and or emotionally abused the women that he was involved with. He didn't know how to express any feelings except anger, and he expressed anger very inappropriately. And he didn't know how to handle conflict at all. And you know, it was years before I realized one day that he was me. You see, that's who I was too. I have much more in common with folks that are alcoholic and have some of those traits than I do otherwise. In addition, I would lie when it would be just as easy to tell the truth. Sometimes I would lie and I'd think, why did you lie about that? There was absolutely no reason to lie, but I would lie anyway. I believed if you'd let me control the world and everybody in it, we would all be so much better off. I could manipulate with the best of them. I was bored with normal. That was kind of boring to me. So if things stayed normal very long, then I would just stir up some chaos. And I was so good at it that at the end of it, you would be apologizing to me because you had started it when I was the one that had done it. I could castrate or crucify you with the words that would come out of my mouth. I would talk you into a corner and hold you there with my words until the only way you could come out would be to push or shove your way out. And then, boy, could I make you feel guilty about that. Now, I'm not proud that that's who I was, but that is who I was, and that is who I am today. But thankfully, I work a very transformative program that allows me to stand before you today, and on most days be a woman of dignity and grace. But that other woman is always there, and sometimes she rears her ugly head, and then I have to inventory and make amends and do those things I need to do to try to make things right. So that was me. In 1978, I was living in a small town in Alabama called Andalusia. Some of you may have heard of it. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and it was in Op, Alabama. We pulled into a church parking lot and got out of the car. I didn't know a thing about Al-Anon. I didn't know what it was, anything. And I walked up to the door, and there was a woman standing in the doorway that I can see this morning as good as I saw her in 1978. Her name was Miss Ina. And she held out her hand to me, and she said, "Honey, you come with me." This was 1978, so her hair was way tall, curls everywhere, brown hair. She had on a royal blue silk dress that belted around the waist. She had on black patent leather high heel shoes. She had her hose on. She had glasses on, a chain around her neck. And she just held out her hand. And I went in the room, and that was my first Al-Anon meeting. I can't tell you one thing that was said that night. You know, sometimes great events happen in our lives, but we don't realize they're great events. And that's the way that night was for me. But I knew I was home. She gave me a One Day at a Time book that I still have today. And on the way home that night, my friend said, "How did you like the meeting?" I said, "Oh, I loved it. But I just don't think I can go back because I don't know any alcoholics." Now, you know, I had been married to several alcoholics by now. Because you see, his wounded heart would call out to my tortured soul. And we would walk off into the sunset to be happily ever after. And for me, that just never worked. It just didn't work. Short-term marriages, short-term relationships, they just didn't work for me. So I said, "So I don't know any alcoholics." I'd been married to several. All my great uncles were alcoholic. My favorite uncles were alcoholic. My favorite aunt was alcoholic. My mother was alcoholic. But you see, to me, they were my uncles. It was Uncle Vernon. It was Aunt Mud. It was my mother. At that time, I didn't associate the behaviors they had with the disease of alcoholism. So my friend said, "Well, you know me," and I did know him. But in 1978 in South Alabama, Al-Anon was made up of women who were married to the men who went to the Alcoholics Anonymous room that met right next door at the same time. And that wasn't who I was. I'm so glad today that Al-Anon is made up of all sorts of us. So I was in and out of Al-Anon for about 12 years. I would go a while, I'd learn just enough to be dangerous, and then I'd run out there and mess up another relationship, and I'd run back in and do a little bit more and run back out there again. And finally, June 15th, 1990, I said, "Angie, you are so blessed. Number one, you have found Al-Anon. You know, most people don't ever find us." Lois Wilson was quite concerned about that. She even wrote about it. I think I'll probably read that quote this afternoon at the workshop. She said, "We are not a secret society. We are not. How are people going to get the good news of recovery? They'll read in the newspaper about people being in alcohol-related accidents or about people being arrested for drinking. But how will they get the good news of recovery?" I worry about that too sometimes. How are people going to get the good news of recovery? Well, I had gotten it. And number two, I could choose to stay. Most people that do find Al-Anon don't stay. Many people come looking for a magic pill to fix their loved one that's drinking, and they find out we don't have a magic pill for their loved one. We just have a magic pill for them, and they go on their search, and they don't come back. Well, I could choose to stay. So June 15th, 1990, I chose to stay, and since that time, I've been a very active and continuing member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen, and have been very grateful for that. It has definitely changed everything in my life, and it has given me a way of life and adventures that I never, ever imagined I would have or that would be possible, all because of this wonderful program that I get to practice. So, that was me at the beginning of Al-Anon. Then, May 18th, 1991, I woke up and decided that I was going to go see my daughter. My daughter was the best thing to come out of my first marriage. Her name is Amanda, and she was in college in North Alabama, in Tuscaloosa. And so, I had not heard from her in 3 months. And that was very unusual, because she and I were pretty close. But I'd been back in Al-Anon for about a year now, and I was really trying to do the best I could do to work the program. So I was waiting for God to let me know what to do about Amanda. And I woke up that morning, and I knew it was time to go see her. So I called my two best friends. I said, I'm going to Tuscaloosa today. Will you go with me? They said, yes. So we get in the car, and we head up to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, from South Alabama, where I live. And on the way, my friend Beretta said, what are we going to do when we get there? And I said, I don't know what we're going to do, but God's going to let us know. And, you know, there are times in my life, if I'm really working this program the way I need to work it, if I'm being a maximum service to God and my fellows, sometimes God just does for me what I can't do for myself. And that whole day was kind of that kind of day for me. We got to Tuscaloosa. We got to the apartment complex where she lived. We got out of the car. And there was a bank of mailboxes out front of that apartment complex, and there was mail scattered all over the ground. We went over and started picking up the mail, and it all had my daughter's name on it. So we gathered the mail up, and we put it in the car and went to her apartment, knocked on the door. Nobody answered. I said, I'm going to go find the apartment manager, get him to come open up the apartment so we can see what's going on. So one friend went with me, and the other friend stayed there, and we walked away, and we were walking downstairs, and my friend Melody called out, and she said, Angie, she's here. And I want to mention here that anybody I talk about in any significant way in my story has given the approval for me to do that. So I turned around and walked back up the stairs, and my daughter Amanda was standing in the doorway. So I walked up to her, and I hugged her, and I said, Amanda, I love you, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. We walked inside, sat down, talked for a few minutes, and I said, Amanda, I want you to know that I'm here today to make you an offer. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, I wonder what the offer's going to be. So then I said, I know something's wrong. I don't know what it is. I don't know what's happening with you, but I know something's wrong. And I'm here today ready to do whatever I need to do to help you. And inside I'm thinking, yay, this is good, you know. I said, I'm willing to take you wherever I need to take you. I'm willing to pay whatever I need to pay. I'm willing to do whatever I need to do. I'm willing to do whatever it is, Amanda, to help. And I'm thinking, this is really great. And then I said, but I want you to know the offer's only good for today. And inside I just screamed out, don't do this. Don't do this. I said, if you accept the offer, great. I'm going to do exactly what I've said. If you don't, that's okay, too. We'll go have lunch. We'll have a great time today. And then I'm going to go home. And I'm still going to be your mama. I'm still going to always love you. I'm still going to see you, everything. But I'll never make you this offer again. And then I stood up and I said, and you have an hour to make up your mind. Well, inside I was just screaming out, don't do this, Angie. Don't do this. But I did and I left. Came back an hour later. I'd cried that whole hour because I knew she wasn't going to accept the offer. My friend said, what are you going to do if she does? I said, it's not going to matter. So we got back. We talked for a few minutes and Amanda said, Mama, I want you to know I accept your offer. Well, you know, my mind was just blank. It was completely blank. And a name came to me of a therapist in Fairhope, Alabama, which is way down South Alabama on the western side of the state. Well, I called Information. For those young people here that don't know, we used to have this lady named Information, and her number was 411, and you could call her. And if you had given her permission, Information would give out your phone number. So I called Information, gave the lady's name. She gave me her number. This was a Saturday morning. I called the lady, and she answered the phone. I told her who I was, told her a little bit about what was going on. Now, by this time, Amanda told me she had written a few bad checks. So I told the therapist she'd written a few bad checks. So we talked a little bit, and the therapist said, well, you know, maybe she has a mental illness. And I said, maybe she does. Because I knew a little bit about that, and I thought, you know, we'll get her some good therapy, get her some good medicine, and she'll be okay. So the therapist said, call me back in a little bit. So I called her back anyway. The result was at 9 o'clock the next morning, I had Amanda at Providence Hospital in Mobile, Alabama, way down South Alabama, where she was admitted to a floor there at that hospital. At that time, there was a floor of that hospital, half of which was for persons with mental illness, and half of which was for persons with alcohol or drug issues. So Amanda was admitted to the half of the floor for persons with mental illness. I met her psychiatrist. His name was Dr. Thomas. He has since gone on to that great meeting in the sky. Dr. Thomas said, what do you think's wrong with your daughter? I said, I don't know. She's written a few bad checks. He said, maybe she has a mental illness. I said, maybe she does. And I left her there, and I went home. Amanda stayed there for 2 months, and every weekend I would go see her. And every weekend she would tell me very serious and dramatic things that had happened in her life that I didn't know about. Some pretty, really serious things. But for me, the most serious was the day that she told me that she was alcoholic. You see, I had been running from the disease of alcoholism and to the disease of alcoholism all of my life. And I knew I had a decision to make that day. Was I going to run from Amanda? Or was I going to run to her? I got home that day and I fell on my knees and I took step one in a way I had never taken it before. I knew my life was unmanageable. I could see the unmanageability all around me. But I did not want to admit I was powerless. I don't know why I held on to that illusion of power so hard, but I did until that day, and I just let it go. I went to the next Al-Anon meeting. I asked Debbie if she would be my sponsor, and we dove into the steps in a way I never had. Step two was easy for me. I have always, always believed that there was something greater than me in the universe that I choose to call God. There has never been a question about that for me. So step two was very easy. But I had been trying to live my life kind of just under the radar of God, right out of his view. Because I really believed if he ever saw me, if he ever truly saw me, he would not want someone like me that had done the things that I had done to be on this beautiful earth that he had created. So I tried to just hide from him. So you can imagine when I got to step three, that was a little bit harder for me, because now I'm asked to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God that I've been hiding from. But I figured out a way I could do that. I said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to turn my will and my life over one day. I'll do that one day. I met my sponsor at the clubhouse. I worked the steps the first time the way she had worked them with her sponsor. So I had a packet, a study guide, all this stuff to read, 12 questions to answer for each step. So we got the clubhouse. I did step three with her. I answered all those questions. But I never told my sponsor I was saying one day. I'm so grateful for a strong arm of my Al-Anon lineage. It goes like this. It starts with Lois Wilson, Bill Wilson's wife, who was the co-founder of Al-Anon. And it goes from her to Arbutus in Texas, and from Arbutus in Texas to a couple other ladies, and then it goes to Lou Bell in Little Rock, Arkansas, Mary Pearl in North Little Rock, Arkansas, Debbie in Delville, Alabama, to me. And in my lineage, when Arbutus was carrying the good news of Al-Anon in Texas, all she had to use was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for allowing us, and I've been told some 300 other kinds of anonymous groups, to use those books. Because that's all we had, and that's what we started with, and those are our foundation. Now, since we've had wonderful Al-Anon literature that's been printed and published, I love our Al-Anon literature. I read it. I use it with sponsees. I study it. But we've also always used the big book in the 12 and 12. So when I finished step three, Debbie said, Angie, when you get home tomorrow and get up, you'll say the third step prayer, and you'll say it every day for the rest of your life. And when we got to seven, she added that on as well. So the next morning when I got up, I had to say that prayer. And as you know, it starts off, God, I offer myself to thee. And it wasn't one day. It was right now. Right now. And I knew God was seeing me. There was a time there that I cried every time I said that prayer, because I truly believed God was just going to kill me. I just knew he was. Well, he didn't. And you know, that shows you that I would have done anything my sponsor suggested I do. I try to remember that today as I sponsor people. I would have done anything she said. There came a time I stopped crying, although I still get kind of misty-eyed sometimes when I say those prayers. Then I started singing them. And today, most days, I sing them, and at the end I say, God, what mission have you got for us today? Let's get on with it. When I finished step three, Debbie handed me a packet. 30 pages, front and back, single space, nothing but question after question after question after question about my life. And she said, this is your four-step inventory. And I said, no, I got the study guide over here, and it's got 12 questions for step four. She said, you'll do that, but you're also going to do this. Well, I used to meet with Debbie an hour before the Al-Anon meeting, and so I got over there to my place, and I'm going through those pages, and I'm already bargaining with God. Because, you see, there was something I'd never told anybody. I'm sure none of us have that. But there was something I had never told anybody. And I knew I didn't have to tell anybody. So I'm going through those pages, and I'm telling God, I know I don't have to tell anybody. And then I said, but just in case I do, God, it's going to be in here. And it's going to say these exact words, God. It's going to say da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's not going to say da-da-da-da-da or da-da-da. It's going to say the exact words, God, da-da-da-da-da-da. And if it does that, then I know I got to tell Debbie. Well, sure enough, about three-fourths of the way through that packet, about halfway down that page, thank goodness, there it was. Da 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 da. And I said, oh God, I'm going to have to tell her. I'm going to have to tell her. The day I did step five, for me, it could have been one question. I got to the clubhouse before Debbie. I watched her drive up. I watched her get out of the car. I watched her walk up to me, because I knew when we got to that question, my relationship with her was going to be different. We walked inside, sat down. We dove in. She would read the question. I would answer. We got to that question. She read it. I answered. I started crying. I was sitting down, and she came over and stood behind me. She just wrapped her arms around me, and I felt something on top of my head, and it was her tears. And in that instant, the shame and the guilt that I felt about what I had done was gone. It was just gone. Now, I still felt responsible. I need to feel responsible for every action and behavior of my life. But the shame and the guilt were just killing me. And it was gone. And you know, my relationship with Debbie did change that day. We were closer than we were before we went in that room. Step 6 and 7, I worked the way I think a lot of people probably do the first time I did it. I worked each of those steps. I met with Debbie. I did the 12 questions. And then I kind of waited for God to do whatever he was going to do. Well, I have learned over the years that I just don't have that kind of God. He expects me to do my part. If I do my part, he will do his part every single time. But he expects me to do my part. And there have been 3 books over the years that have really helped me learn what my part of 6 and 7 are. And they are Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect, and Steps and Stories by Sandy Beach. Those 3 books just opened up steps 6 and 7 to me in a way that nothing else has. And I live a lot of life today in those steps. So, as I said, Amanda stayed in that treatment center for 2 months. The day she was released, I went to pick her up. And I had a contract for her to look at. Now, I had written the contract myself. I come from a long line of martyrs. You know, woe is me, I can't believe you've done all this to me. How could you do this to me? Blah, 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 blah. And I didn't want to be that kind of person anymore. So the contract was for me. It was to try to help things be even Stephen with Amanda and I so I couldn't martyr her. So the contract said things like, I agreed not to have men spend the night in our home if she came and stayed with me for a little bit. She agreed not to have men spend the night in our home. I agreed I would buy groceries. She had to agree to cook 3 nights a week. At that time, she didn't have a car, so I agreed she could use my car sometimes. She had to agree to keep my car cleaned and detailed. I agreed she could stay with me. She had to agree to pay me $100 a month rent. See, for everything I did, she did something, so it kept everything even. Now, if Amanda was here today, I need to mention this too. We had gone through all that mail, and I had learned that Amanda was facing at least 15 years at Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama because of the amount of bad checks that she had written. So I had paid that all that money off. It was over $10,000. And the contract said that Amanda had 10 years to pay that money back to me, or she would go to Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama. She paid the money back in 8 years. But she would tell you if she was here today, she looked at that contract and she thought, mama or prison? Mama or prison? Well, she picked mama. She signed it. I signed it. And we went home to Dothan, Alabama, where I was living, to learn how to be a family in recovery. So I'll share a couple of quick stories about that. She'd been living with me several months. And I came home one day, and she said, Mama, you know I'm going to do everything you wanted me to do. I'm working hard. I'm going to meetings. I got a sponsor. I'm working the steps. I got 6 part-time jobs. I'm cleaning. I'm cooking. I'm doing all this stuff, Mama. But I just don't think I'm going to have the rent money tomorrow. But I'm doing everything else you want me to do, and I'm doing it good. And so I said, Amanda, you are absolutely right. I hope you are so proud because you are doing everything I've asked you to do and more. And it's okay if you don't have the rent money when I get home tomorrow. Because you see, I went and talked to the Salvation Army before I brought you home. And they told me I could drop you off any time. And they would give you 2 hots and a cot. So when I get home tomorrow, if the rent money's not on the table, that's okay. I'm still going to be your mother. I'm still going to love you. We'll do things together. But I'm going to take you and your things to the Salvation Army and drop you off. And you'll never live with me again because you will have broke our contract. And anything you want, you better take because whatever you leave here is going to be mine. Well, you can imagine, her eyes were as big as dinner plates. I got up, went in the bathroom, got in the shower, my favorite place to cry, and I just boo-hooed because I knew I could do that. I knew I could. You know, there'd been some times in Amanda's life that I would say things to her that I wouldn't say to the checkout clerk at the grocery store. There'd been some times in her life I would use a tone of voice that I wouldn't use to a teller at the bank. There'd been some times in her life that I had made gestures and, you know, head gestures and eye rolling and all that kind of stuff that I wouldn't do with a stranger I'm sitting next to on a plane. And I really thought those days were pretty much over that day because I could finally see Amanda as a person deserving of dignity and respect. And if any of us in this room had a contract together and one of us broke it, there would be consequences for that. That's just how the world works. And Amanda was deserving of that same dignity and respect as any of us would be. I got home the next day, the rent money was on the table, and it was there every month until she moved out. Another thing I started learning that year, I still learn today, and it goes like this. If my name is not in the sentence, it is none of my business. And this is how that works. Sometimes I would say to Debbie, boy, I wonder if Amanda's going to her meetings. And Debbie would say, Angie, your name is not in that sentence. So then I would say, boy, I wonder if Amanda, Angie's daughter, is going to her meetings. And Debbie would say, you cannot do that. Your name is not in that. Here's some other sentences that don't have my name. Was Amanda going to meetings? Was Amanda a good home group member? As the years have gone on, was Amanda a loving wife? Is Amanda a caring mother? Is Amanda a woman of dignity and grace, speaking her truth and kindness and love? Is Amanda an upstanding citizen? And on and on and on. My name is in none of those sentences. But here are some sentences that do have my name. Is Angie going to her meetings? Is Angie working her steps? Does Angie have a sponsor? Is Angie being a good home group member? Is Angie being a loving wife? Is Angie being a kind mother? Is Angie being an awesome grandmother? Is Angie being a woman of dignity and grace? Is speaking her truth in kindness and love? And on and on and on. I learned that my name was in enough sentences. I really didn't have a lot of time left over to worry about those that didn't have my name. Amanda celebrated 32 years in Alcoholics Anonymous this year. Thanks to the program that she works and the God of her understanding and some wonderful sponsorship over the years. And she has a great marriage. Her husband's name is Gary. He's a regular old fella who loves all of us because he loves her. I have two beautiful grandchildren that I adore. And Amanda and I love each other. We're still mother and daughter. We're always going to be mother and daughter. But we love each other today, and we both work programs of recovery. And it's a wonderful way of life. It's a wonderful way of life. My mother never did get in recovery. The last few years of her life, she had COPD and emphysema such that she could no longer drive to go buy the alcohol. So she didn't drink, but she was not in recovery. And for most of those 2 years, she lived with me 2 or 3 weeks out of the month and with my daughter 2 weeks out of the month because I went out of town some of those 2 weeks. And then 3 weekends out of 4, I would take her to her home in Andalusia so she could be at her home. And I never could have done that if I had not been raised in the program of Al-Anon and open AA meetings. Because that's where I learned how to do that. And I didn't learn it in an hour meeting a week. My sponsor said, Angie, you have the family disease of alcoholism. It serves you well to learn everything you can about it. So we got in the car and we went. Us Al-Anons, we usually have one state convention a year, one district picnic, and one workshop. And that's all we have. But AA folks are doing stuff all the time. And most all of it is with Al-Anon participation, thank goodness. So we went. And I went to roundups, and I went to conventions, and I went to weekends, and we would rent a house on the lake, and there would be 40 of us that would go, and you wouldn't know who was AA or who was Al-Anon, and we'd have a 12-step weekend or a promise weekend or some kind of weekend. And all those times and all those ways, I got to watch you and see how you related to each other. I got to hear your stories. I get some people say to me, I don't go to the AA speaker because I'm Alan. I've learned something from every speaker I've just about ever heard. You know? How they related to their parents. How they related to their families. I would see how you related with each other. I learned that a man could love me and not want to have sex with me in these rooms. I learned that I could love a man and with no expectations. I learned to love women. I hated women when I came to Al-Anon. I learned all about relationships in the rooms of recovery. So when my mother needed a loving daughter, I could be one. And I was one. One day she was sitting on the couch at my house and she said, I know you talk about me when you speak, and at that time I did not. So I said, no ma'am, I don't talk about you when I speak. And she said, I know you do. And I said, no ma'am, I don't. And then she said, I know you talk about when I used to beat you. And I thought, oh my goodness. We had never talked about that. I sure didn't talk about it in public, you know. And I said, no ma'am, I don't talk about that. And she said, I know you do. And I said, no, I do not. And then she said, which I think she was trying to make an amends to me. She said, well, you know, I didn't beat you every day. And I thought, we are here, you know. And so I said, no, ma'am, you didn't beat me every day, but you beat me many days. And one day was one day too many. And then I really looked at her, and I had what happened to me happen to a speaker I heard one time. I truly believe that God allowed me to see my mother the way he probably sees her. And I saw this little shriveled 82-year-old woman sitting there tethered to an oxygen tank with the things in her nose. She had her pajamas on in the middle of the day. Her hair was a little bit disheveled. She was all hunched over, tiny. She used to be 60 feet tall to me, this little tiny woman, scared, afraid, alone, so fearful. And I went over and I knelt down in front of her and I said, Mama, I want you to know I have forgiven you for that. I said, do you remember that day I came to see you and I talked to you about things that I had done to you that hurt you? She said, yeah. I said, well, I had already forgiven you that day. You see, when I got to step 8 and I made my list, Debbie said, we've got some work to do here. She said, yes, you have done things that have harmed all these people, but a lot of these people have harmed you. And she said, before you can go and make amends, you have to forgive them so that when you do go to make amends, you can go with an absolutely pure heart that has nothing in it but love, so that no matter what they say or what they do, it's not going to matter, because you will know that you were a loving daughter or relative or friend or whatever, ex-wife, whatever, when you went, and you made a loving amends. So I had worked on forgiving my mother for a while before I ever went. And I told her, I said, I forgave you that day, and I'm so sorry I didn't tell you. And that's why I tell this story, because I was sorry I didn't tell her that day that I had forgiven her. And I said, I forgive you, Mother. And I said, I love you. And you know, we hugged each other and we cried together. And I think it was the second time in my life I ever saw my mother cry, because she lived behind a 10-foot wall that nothing could get in and nothing could get out. And I believe I saw that day who I would have been without the program of Al-Anon and without Open AA. In 2006, I realized, I was inventorying that day and realized that I had never turned over the part of my life that had to do with male-female relationships to God. I would not give that to God. I don't know why. By now, the wreckage is right here at my chin, but I'm still believing I can do this male-female stuff better than God can. But that day, I finally said, I give up. I surrender. I surrender. And I did turn that part of my life over to God. And I told God, I said, you know, God, I can't do this. I've never been able to do it. I don't know how to do it. When I try to do it, I mess it up. I'm done. I'm done. I'm just going to learn how to be a single, happy, joyous, and free woman in recovery. And I said, if you ever decide to put somebody in my life, you're going to have to put them in front of my face and keep them there, because I'm not going to look anymore. I'm not going to go places looking for them. My friends, this will tell you how long ago it was, my friends were trying me to do this, to get me to do this new stuff that was happening on computers like kisskisskiss.net and loveyouforever.com. You know, you'd go on there and meet people and all this stuff. And I said, I'm not doing any of that. Not going to go there. Not going to do it. And I also looked at my spiritual life, step 11, because I realized God was a big kahuna in the sky to me. And I wanted him to be a big kahuna in the sky, but I also wanted him to be my best friend, and he wasn't. I wanted him to be walking with me on the street, and I wanted to be able to talk with him just like I'm talking right now. And I wanted him to be with me in the car and in the bathroom and everywhere, and he wasn't. He was this big kahuna in the sky, which I wanted him to be, but I also wanted a best friend. So I changed my spiritual life up. I started doing some things different. I started reading some different literature and talking to different people and doing some stuff there. I said, I'm going to go to therapy. I'm going to start going through all this wreckage. I'm going to see what got me here. And I did. I got in therapy and I went on this journey. And it was an 8-year journey. Oh, I said, I'm not going to date. I'm going to turn down dates. I'm not going to date. I'm going to go on this journey. And I did for 8 years. This cute girl came up to me one time. She was probably 22. I hope I see her again one day. She said, oh, my God, Miss Angie, are you telling me I can't date for 8 years? I said, no, honey, I'm not telling you that. I don't know how much wreckage you've got. I had a lot of wreckage to go through. I said, but I am telling you this. Don't settle. Don't settle. We know when we're settling. We feel that little nudge. We hear that little voice. I settled about so much in my life. I settled about jobs. I settled about where to live. I settled about who to marry, who to divorce. Don't settle. Just don't settle. So I went on this journey. In March the 8th, 2014, I'd been on it for 8 years. And so I'm going to the Flint River Roundup that day. I'm on host Bo T, who was a dear friend of mine. And I packed up, and I was talking to God. I was just talking away to him when I'm packing and getting stuff ready, because, see, he's my best friend now, and I can just talk to him. And so as I was leaving the house, I said, God, I just want you to know that I have done everything you wanted me to do, and I'm ready. Well, I shot myself. Got to the Flint River Roundup. I was rooming with a friend of mine named Jean. I just had breakfast with her a day before yesterday, and we talked to, she still remembers that day. I walked in the room. She knew something that had happened. She said, Angie, what has happened? So I told her. And I said, Jean, I told God. I've done everything you wanted me to do, and I just want you to know I'm ready. And then I said, because I have that kind of God today, I said, let's see how long it takes God. Well, Chip and I have a picture that is still on our refrigerator today that was made that next day. My daughter made it of he and I on the stage there at the Flint River Roundup. And a 14-year acquaintanceship friendship started to change. I guess 14 years in front of my face was long enough. 6 months later, we were married. And I've had my first ever second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth wedding anniversaries. And marriage is a pretty neat deal. It's a pretty neat deal, you know. We've had grand fun times together. Chip's had some health issues the last several years, which has really changed our relationship in a lot of ways. But I still love and adore that man that I had my picture made with on that stage at that Flint River Roundup in 2014. So that brings me to step 12. I have had a spiritual awakening. Not because I go to meetings, not because I speak once in a while, not because I set up the chairs at my home group. I've had a spiritual awakening. Those things are important, but I've had a spiritual awakening because I have worked the steps with a sponsor who has worked the steps. Now what do I do with the spiritual awakening that I've gotten? I am told that I'm to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. Well, what does that look like and what does that mean in my life? You know, it's pretty easy to be of maximum service in an hour meeting. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But what am I doing the other 23 hours of the day? I find that my maximum service to God and my fellows has a lot to do with people outside these rooms than it does in these rooms. It's easy. Y'all are easy to be a maximum service to, except maybe at a business meeting. You know, it can get a little testy. But what do I do in all those other ways? So I'm going to share a couple stories about that, and then I'll be done. In 2016, Chip and I were at the Gulf Shores Jubilee in Gulf Shores, Alabama, and we were standing in the food line. And Chip was in line, and I was in front of him. And in front of me was a young man named John. And at that time, I think John was 35, 36 maybe. And John is a dear friend of my daughter's. And so I knew John. And so John and I are talking. And John had been in AA at that time, I think about 8 or 9 years. And so we're talking. And so I said, how's it going? And he's telling me everything, you know. And then he got real serious. He said, Angie, I'm really having a hard time with my recovery. And I said, oh, no, what's going on? And he said, well, he said, I want to make amends to my parents. He said, I'm on step 9. He said, but they're both deceased. His dad had died when he was 9, and his mom had died when he was 28. He said, I'm having such a hard time. So we talked a little bit. And, you know, I have kind of a standard thing I usually say when somebody tells me that they're trying to make amends to somebody that's deceased. But I felt that little nudge. I felt that little nudge, and I paid attention to it. So that's not what I said. What I said was, well, John, we're standing right here. And so John looked at me, and he got real teary, and I got real teary, and we looked at Chip. And he said, oh, my God, would you be my parents? And Chip and I looked at each other, and we looked at John. We said, absolutely we will. And so since 2014, John has been our son. And it has been wonderful. It has been wonderful. He wanted to live. He's always wanted to live at the beach, so we started looking for a job. He got a fantastic job in Destin. He came down to live with us for about 6 months when he was getting a place to stay. He would come home every day, and I would have dinner ready, just like my mom did when he would come home, you know, and we'd all sit down and eat together. And he came in one day, and he said, I can't tell you the last time that I came home to family. And I said, well, John, I can't tell you the last time that family came home to us every day like you do, because, you know, it had been years since Amanda had gone away from home. We were sitting there talking one day, and he said, you know, Angie, he said, my parents loved me so good, but they didn't know all of who I am. And he said, you and Chip know all of who I am, and you love me so good. And I knew in that instant, that's why that day in 2014, I didn't give John the standard thing I usually say. And I said, we're right here. He had to have some surgery, and he lives on the second floor, so he came and stayed with us, and I got to take him to physical therapy, and I've gotten to really be a mom, and he's gotten to really be a son. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful relationship that would never have happened without recovery. 5 or 6 years ago now, I realized that I was saying things on social media that a woman of dignity and grace didn't need to be saying. I was arguing with people. I was being smarty with people. I was fussing with people. I was bad. I was just bad. I was bad. And at that time, my sponsor was on no social media at all, so she did not know what I was doing. But you know, I have sponsees that are on social media, and they saw what I was doing. So I finally called my sponsor, and I told her what I'd been doing. She said, oh, my God, Angie. I said, I know. Tell me about it. She said, we got work to do here. She said, we've got to look at causes and conditions. We've got to look at what got you here, and we've got to look at what we're going to do about it. Well, what we're going to do about it was pretty easy. I had to go make amends to social media world, which I did. I went on social media and I said, you know, I have not been behaving as a woman of grace and dignity on social media. I've been saying things and doing things that I don't need to be saying or doing. Here's all my contact information. If I have said or done anything in any way that has harmed you, offended you, caused you any concerns at all, please contact me, and I'm going to do everything I can do to make that right. And I also am saying today that I'm going to do my best from this day forward to only be a woman of dignity and grace on any kind of social media and in my life. And I have done my best since that day to do that. And then we looked at what had gotten me there. And what had gotten me there was I realized I was living again in a place of fear. Before I got in recovery, most of my life was lived in fear. I made decisions based on fear, married people based on fear, divorced based on fear, married based on fear, 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 fear. But when I got in recovery and worked the steps, the fear went away. Now, I didn't work on fear. It was just as a result of working those 12 steps, the fear was gone. But it was back. And for me, underneath fear is always a lack of faith and trust in God. Always. So I had to beef up my spiritual program, do some things there. When I did, the fear went away. And I believe as long as I can stay pretty spiritually fit, that fear's not going to come back anymore. It's just not. A couple of years ago, I was watching news one night. This is my last story and I'll be done. I was watching the news one night. And the newscaster was talking about all these people doing all these things to all these people in all these ways and all these places, you know. And in the middle of that newscast, I said, oh my gosh. This is my God now. God expects me to love every one of those people that newscaster is talking about just as much as he loves me. God loves all those people being talked about just as much as he loves me. How can God do that? I don't have an ego, do I? How can God do that? How can he love those people as much as he loves me? How dare he? And I went on a rant at God. I was so mad at God. I was mad and angry at God for weeks. How could he do that? How could he do that? I inventoried it, talked to my sponsor about it, did everything I could. And finally I realized I was at a crossroads. I was at a crossroads. Was I going to have a great big all-encompassing God of love? Or was I going to have a little bitty God that looked like me, talked like me, walked like me, voted like me, believed like me, all like me? Which was I going to have? Well, I knew the answer that I was going to need to make, so I waited another week because I didn't really want to make it. Because I knew what it was going to mean. So I ran in for about another week. But finally I did make that decision, talked to my sponsor, made the decision and said, you know, I want that all-encompassing God of love. And I knew what that meant was. God expected me to love every one of the people on that newscast just as much as he loved me. And so that's a journey that I've been on since that day. And I believe that that's a journey that I will be on the rest of my life. Sometimes it means trying to find one grain of sand in common with somebody. And if you live on the beach like I do, you know, trying to find one grain of sand is a pretty tall order. But I believe that's what I'm expected to do because I'm a woman of grace and dignity in recovery. And I believe when I joined the rooms of recovery, there were obligations and responsibilities that came along with that. And I'm expected to do that. I'm expected to be a woman of grace and dignity, and I'm expected to love people. You know, what is the girl that usually waits on me at Starbucks? What's she going to think about Al-Anon? If she comes to our first meeting Tuesday night and she sees me sitting there, what's the lady that waits on me a lot of times at the grocery store going to think? If she comes to the Al-Anon meeting and sees me sitting there, you know, I'm a walking, breathing advertisement for Al-Anon every day. Every day. And just because I don't know who knows that, they might not know it today, but they might know it tomorrow. They might know it tonight. You know, what kind of advertisement am I? To y'all, but also to everybody out there. Because we are, that's what it means to me when it says, we are a program of attraction, not promotion. How attractive am I? You know, would anybody want what I have? Or would they think, man, I don't want to go to those Al-Anon meetings. They come out and they're sour and fussing and, you know, what do they think? So, that's my story. While we're meeting today, there are people meeting in person now all over the world, thank goodness, and Zooming and everything that we get to do today. And they're all doing what we're going to do and did last night. They're all sharing their language of the heart with each other. My name is Angie Baldwin, and I thank you for letting me share my language of the heart with you. Thank you.